Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Hey, listener, Zach Harper here. Underdog Fantasy, the easiest place to play fantasy sports. Also, fastest growing fantasy app in the industry. Here's how it works. The Pick'em game. Pick whether your favorite players will have a higher or lower stat total in this week's game for a chance to win big. How big, you ask? I'm so glad you asked that question, listener. You can win up to 100 times your money in a single night. Pick between 2 and 5 players, build a pick'em entry. You can also do rivals picks. You can put like Tyrese Haliburton and Jalen Brunson against each other, and whoever has more points, more assists, more rebounds, whatever you want to do, that is your rivals pick. I would maybe go with Jalen Brunson in these playoffs. By the way, in the regular season, Jalen Brunson, scoring tear, going higher on his point totals all the time. Joel Embiid, whenever he did actually play, higher on his scoring totals all the time. Victor Wembanyama, for the next 15, 20 years, here's a pro tip for you, take higher on the blocks. That's right. So you're probably wondering, how do you sign up? Oh my God, listener, you are full of good questions today. Sign up with the promo code DING, that's D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. $250, man, that's a lot. Visit underdogfantasy.com or find them in the App Store. And don't forget to register with our code DING, D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick and first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. Must be 18 or older, 21 or older in Massachusetts, Arizona, 19 or older in Alabama and Nebraska, and present in a state where Underdog Fantasy operates. Terms apply. Concerned with your play, call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.ncpgambling.org. Arizona 1-800-NEXT-STEP. That's 1-800-639-8783. Or text NEXT STEP to 53342. New York, call the 24/7 HOPE line at 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest edition of the Woke Bros, of course. I'm your co-host, Big Waz, a.k.a. Wozny Lambre, joined as always by my brother, my partner, my compatriot, here on the West Coast, Los Angeles, sunny L.A. Yes, we're killing it. It's Nando Vila on the West Side. What's good, brother?
Good to be back. Good to be back. I spent a week on the East Coast. It's good to be back on the Left Coast.
I hear that. On today's show, we have a few... I'm really excited about today's show. this is a Woke Bros big dog right here. But first, man, just a little house cleaning, please. This is that time of the year where we have to come hat in hand and beg you guys, the listeners, the viewers, to support what we do here at Count the Dings. Honestly, the support of the Patreon is how we're able to bring you all of this amazing content. I get messages all the time about this show specifically, man, and what people get out of it, how much they enjoy it, which makes me proud, obviously. It's my favorite thing that I do. It just goes without saying. But anyway, we need you guys' support. Please become a Patreon member of Count the Dings. That's patreon.com/countthedings. It's basically a cup of coffee, you know, a month. If you ever get artisanal coffee, it's a cup of coffee per month to support what we do here at Count the Dings, man. We try not to beg people for money, specifically in a global pandemic. So many people are struggling. But if you can find it within your budget to spare basically about $5 a month to, ensure that we could keep bringing you this amazing content, please go to patreon.com/countthedings. Support what we do. There's extra content on there. Just please support what we do. Thank you. Now that we got that out of the way, on today's show, the people of Colombia have hit the streets. It started off as a sort of tax reform revolt, which I just love the idea of that, of, you know, former President Trump passing his record tax cuts for the rich and everybody hitting the streets in America. That would never happen. Didn't happen. But I just love the idea of that. Imagine if that happened, right? If people were just like, nah, screw that. We're not going to take this. Didn't happen here, but it's happening in Colombia. What started off as a tax revolt has basically been a repudiation of the entire regime of Uribe. So we're going to get into the ins and outs of that. Neoliberalism run amok out in South America. Of course, we also have to talk about Nate Cohen's latest report in the New York Times. Shouts to Nate Cohen. You know, he's a data analyst. I know a lot of people don't like the data nerds in politics. I happen to not mind. He's not making any sort of grand declarations about anything. He's just like, look, we used to think it was this thing that was going to happen, but now we realize it's this. And I talked about this on Wozni, the TYT Twitch stream last night, but demographics will not save the Democratic Party. That has kind of been the rallying cry for years now. Basically, ever since Barry, there was this idea of this multiracial, multicultural demographic. Non-whites were going to become the majority and the Democrats would just dominate. Just based off demographics alone. Racial solidarity, Nando. That's all. Yep. Racial solidarity. That's all we need. Yep. We're going to get into Nate Cohen's report and break down why the Dems need to come up with a different strategy. But first, Lord have mercy, Nando. Lord. Sometimes you run across some things on the internet that defy logic, defy everything I know about life itself. And I'm just like, no, this has to be a joke. Like, they're trolling me. This is a joke. They're kidding, right?
Yeah.
They're not actually doing this, right? And this time, Nando, it happens to be a recruitment video made by the CIA where they get a young brown woman to just literally spew every single woke platitude that has ever been uttered within the last 5 years and basically explain why the CIA is great. Because the CIA, just by virtue of the CIA employing brown people, they're great.
Yeah.
That's the message of the video. That's the message. At no point do black sites or waterboarding or regime change of democratically elected governments, at no point did that come up.
No.
Just this lady's, the sentence, "I am intersectionality," came out of this lady's mouth.
Yeah. Wait, before we go on, we should give some space for Rob to clip in the video because
play the video.
You have to
listen to the video first.
When I was 17, I quoted Zora Neale Hurston's "How It Feels to Be Colored Me" in my college application essay. The line that spoke to me stated simply, "I am not tragically colored. There is no sorrow dammed up in my soul nor lurking behind my eyes. I do not mind at all." At 17, I had no idea what life would bring, but Sora's sentiment articulated so beautifully how I felt as a daughter of immigrants then and now. Nothing about me was or is tragic. I am perfectly made. I can wax eloquent on complex legal issues in English while also belting Guayaquil de mis amores in Spanish. I can change a diaper with one hand and console a crying toddler with the other. I am a woman of color. I am a mom. I am a cisgender millennial who's been diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. I am intersectional, but my existence is not a box-checking exercise. I am a walking declaration, a woman whose inflection does not rise at the end of her sentences, suggesting that a question has been asked. I did not sneak into CIA. My employment was not and is not the result of a fluke or slip through the cracks. I earned my way in, and I earned my way up the ranks of this organization. I am educated, qualified, and competent, and sometimes I struggle. I struggle feeling like I could do more, be more to my two sons, and I struggle leaving the office when I feel there's so much more to do. I used to struggle with imposter syndrome, but at 36, I refuse to internalize misguided patriarchal ideas of what a woman can or should be. I am tired of feeling like I'm supposed to apologize for the space I occupy rather than intoxicate people with my effort, my brilliance. I am proud of me, full stop. My parents left everything they knew and loved to expose me to opportunities they never had. Because of them, I stand here today a proud first-generation Latina and officer at CIA. I am unapologetically me. I want you to be unapologetically you, whoever you are. Know your worth. Command your space. Mija, you're worth it.
This is it. This is how the power structure has effectively co-opted the concept of wokeness. It's just...
Yeah.
Nothing. I don't know nothing about how much she gets paid. I don't know nothing about what's the Benny's package. I don't like, first of all, just like what it means to work there. Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing about that. And then of course, the CIA could never actually advertise what their core values as a freaking organization are. Their mission, as far as what they actually do. What do you do when you go to work, lady, besides be brown and intersectional? What is your job at the CIA? It never comes up.
Yeah, we've joked about in the past the concept of woke imperialism, which is a thing that is very real. And it just, you know, and we always kind of are skeptical of a lot of this woke language, because I think from my perspective, it is so focused on the individual, right? It is focused on your own kind of experience in the world as an individual, not as the part of a collective, that it becomes so easy for multinational CEOs, from major corporations, which are doing all kinds of evil all over the world, to adopt this kind of language. It comes very easy for now the CIA to adopt this kind of language. I mean, it's like,
Can you come back to why the problem with focusing on the individual as opposed to the whole becomes problematic?
Well, because if we focus on ourselves as individuals, it undermines solidarity.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
That's what the effect of a lot of this kind of woke discourse has been, is to undermine solidarity between different groups of people. Because if everything becomes hyper-racialized, and if everything becomes about your own disabilities or anxieties or traumas or whatever, it's an inward focusing thing rather than something that builds bonds with other people and allows you to exercise your power as a collective, right? That's the only way to really change anything, is to exercise people power as a collective. But this kind of discourse about, like, I mean, when she was like, I am a cisgender millennial diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder.
What the fuck does that mean? What does it have to know? Do with anything?
Yeah. And it's like, it sort of treats us all as individual, atomized people rather than as members of a society, of a collective that can exercise collective power. So that's kind of why I find this kind of discourse to be troubling, because, and it's why it's been so easily co-opted by these insanely powerful actors as a way to claim a mantle of progressivism when they're just really not. Like, I mean, I'm sorry, but like Nike, you know, Nike doing Colin Kaepernick while like doing slavery in the third world and like sweatshops, like that's a classic example. Or like Apple, you know, which like does all kinds of horrible things in their factories in China.
But their CEO's like
that, but, like,
gay.
The CEO's gay, and then like, it's like they're progressive.
So they're great. You know?
Like, and now the CIA, which is like maybe one of the most evil institutions like ever created.
Maybe.
By
it's not maybe by, it's by up man.
There. Yeah, is claiming this mantle of like progressivism by adopting this kind of radical language. I mean, this is like radical academia language. And what I find interesting is that this kind of language, which has been basically created at elite academic institutions, right? Like this was invented by people who went to Harvard and liberal arts colleges and mm-hmm. things like that, in academic circles, has become so dominant amongst that class. And because the CIA needs to recruit people from those institutions, right? Like you don't work at the CIA unless you went to a top university. And they need to attract those people where they're like, okay, well, now we got to do that to get these guys, to get these people. We got to start talking like we were a Tumblr teen from 5 years ago, talking about like my lived experience as someone with imposter syndrome, you know, and whether like I can claim that as a genuine disability. And like that's where this kind of language is so easily co-opted, and that's what's a problem with it. Whereas the language of solidarity, the language of class war, the language of us against
gets pushed,
them
pushed to the side,
pushed to the side, and that's the real thing that is a threat to them. Not this kind of stuff about intersectionality and I'm a cisgender
first
millennial. It's just like it's not
all,
a threat to power.
First of course, because it further isolates you from people.
Yeah,
exactly. Like this, and I say it all the time. I'm like, yo, my problem with fancy Negroes is that normal Black people don't talk like this.
Yeah.
Do you want to be in communication and solidarity with normal Black people? Then you got to stop using shit like what's the word? Shit, misogynoir.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what? You can't go to fucking Flatbush, Brooklyn and talk to somebody on Newkirk Ave like that?
Yeah.
And if you do, it's because you don't want to be in league with them. You just don't. You don't want to work in concert with
them.
Go to,
like,
a
working class, Salvadorian guy or Mexican guy and tell him that he's Latinx. Like, he'll look at you like you just called him, like, you know, like you called him something, like an insult or something. Or, like, what'd you call me? Like,
it's this, yeah. This language is used to further isolate. And that's the point of a that's the whole point of an organization like the CIA anyway, is to isolate people, is to marginalize people, is to keep the existing power structures in place. That's all they exist to do. So the idea that they would hire a brown person in service of that goal and that mission, why should anybody be surprised by that? You know, if you want to tell me the CIA put a bunch of brown people in charge and they're no longer doing what they're doing in South America, then I'd be like, shit, maybe this works.
Yeah.
But we know that's not the case.
So... the problem, the left argument against the kind of liberal woke discourse is that in the liberal imagination, the existing power structures are fine. The only problem is that you need to diversify the people within those power structures, right? So like, you know, the problem with CEOs is that they're too white and male, not that they have too much power and money.
Exactly.
And so as long as we make more, 50% female and,
exactly.
13% Black and whatever, like that is the political goal. And that has been the political goal of a lot of the sort of political class of minority groups, whether it's like, you know, the Black political class or the Latino political class or the Asian political class. Remember, I mean, you saw like, you know, Asian lawmakers kind of threatening to do undermine Biden if he didn't nominate an AAPI person to the cabinet or whatever. Like that's their that's the extent of their political imagination. Whereas the left says that if you really want to help people who are Black and Latino or Asian and who are oppressed, is you have to change the relationship between regular people and power. You have to reduce inequality. You have to reduce power distribution at the top. And that's the goal, not diversifying the existing power structure. That does nothing. You'll always find people who are willing to oppress their own people. I mean, this has been a case forever. I mean, they had, you know, the House Negroes in the antebellum South.
This
they
goes
had.
Without, I mean, like, yeah, this
it's
is,
like
this
it's always been that way.
Sense.
Yeah,
it's just common sense. Candace Owens, you name it. Like,
yeah,
there's always going to be, yes, people who are willing to oppress the class of which they came from. That's not hard. It's not hard to understand. And so that brings us to Nando.
Yep.
Nate Cohen's report. And it's so obvious like what the deal is, what's going on here, right? Again, this rhetoric sprang out of Barry's historic win in 08, where, you know, the Dems were feeling themselves. It's like, yo, we ran a Black dude. We won rural whites, Latinx folks, Black people was obviously on board. We got suburban whites. This coalition is going to be ridiculous. We're going to kill people with this coalition. And they learned all of the wrong lessons from 08.
Yeah.
Which Barry's campaign was slightly like class-based.
It was in both campaigns.
Yes, it was a message of class politics and, you know, the elites messing everything up. And, you know, they sent us to Iraq. They did X, Y, and Z. We need to give people healthcare. It was populism. You know, it wasn't this damn rainbow coalition. America's beautiful. Now nobody cares about that shit for real. Like, nobody actually gives a fuck about any of that stuff except for elite libs. Yes, that makes y'all feel warm and fuzzy at night. You know why? Because you all have great jobs. You all will always have great jobs. You live in great cities. The rest of your life is straight. So you start caring. You start centering this fucking, you know, this sort of esoteric shit type of shit, man. Like, you elite libs get to center that stuff because, generally speaking, they have great lives. Right. But Barry was speaking to something different. And that's what that was the winning message, not this rainbow coalition nonsense that y'all want to run with. And so the Dems said, listen, the country's getting more brown. You know, sooner or later, it's going to be majority non-white. All those non-whites are going to love us just because we're not Republican. And it's going to guarantee us majorities forever. And, you know, to the extent that, you know, that made any sense, the Republicans actually believed that, too. You know, and yeah, they were scared shit. When they did the postmortem, they were like, look, man, we actually have natural allies who are brown people. We should be going after them. But then the base was like, are you fucking kidding me? They're wetbacks. was the Republican base, you know, and so they couldn't really do it.
That's right. I mean, I remember that what they called the postmortem, or I think they called it the autopsy report at the time. This was after the 2012 election when they thought they were going to beat Barack Obama. They were convinced they were going to beat him. And then he actually won pretty easily. He didn't win by the historic margins of 2008, but he won.
He destroyed Mitt Romney.
Yeah. And Mitt Romney, who is, you know, had made a very, very hard turn against immigration, if you remember that. Which was a newish thing for the Republican Party. George Bush ran in 2004. Pro-immigration reform, won 50% of the Latino vote, if you think about that. George Bush won 50% of the Latino vote.
Lord have mercy.
Close to it. It was 48% or something like that. Mitt Romney did a hard turn against immigration. He created that term self-deportation, if you remember. We're going to make the conditions here so horrible for undocumented immigrants that they will self-deport. And then the Republican autopsy was, we need to change our tune on immigration because we need to win over Latino voters. And that's how we're going to stop this bleeding that we're, you know, we're bleeding non-white voters, and the non-white voters are getting more and more. So you're right that both parties assumed that demographics were destiny, that the brown people of America, the browning of America, was an inevitable boon for the Democrats. Well, that did not happen for various reasons. Trump came and went even harder against immigration and won. And then he somehow upped his margins with Latino voters the second time around, and with Black voters. And I think that there's two fundamental things that they misunderstand. One is that they assume all brown people are like the Black people in America, in the sense that Black people in America have a very unique shared history.
Exactly.
It comes from slavery. They've been here for 400 years. It's a deep-rooted and shared experience that manifests itself politically as a more unified political bloc. But also, Black people remember when a time when the Democratic Party actually delivered real gains for them, i.e. civil rights in 1964. Black people used to vote Republican. Why? Because Lincoln freed the slaves. The Republican Party freed the slaves.
Yep.
And for close to 70 years after that, they voted Republican no matter what. But then, you know, the Republican Party immediately after the Civil War got captured by business interests. They became like an incredibly pro-capitalist, you know, the party of big business. And when Franklin Roosevelt came along and did the New Deal, Black people switched from Republicans to Democrats. That was a huge political shift in the 1930s. And then by the 1960s, when Democrats delivered civil rights, that completed
then it. Would the just, Black, it just completed yeah. it. And, you know, obviously the Southern whites, who they were poor as hell when FDR passed the New Deal. He lifted them up out of poverty, gave them dignity, union jobs, et cetera, et cetera. Social Security, you fucking name it. They were staunchly Democrat because of that. It was it was always uneasy bedfellows, to be sure. But, you know, we're seeing the results of basically the Civil Rights Act. The coalitions right now are, like, you can just trace it back. Of course, it starts with FDR, but the Civil Rights Act is what really was just like, no. We're never doing this Democrats thing again down there in the South.
Right. But Black people vote. That's why Black people vote Democrat, like 90-10 usually. But what do Latinos got to point to from Democrats?
Nothing.
What have Democrats ever done for Latinos?
Nothing.
They don't have anything like that. You know, they don't have the equivalent of their Civil Rights Act that they can point to as like, we organized politically and we won this concrete gain from this party. Therefore, we're loyal to this party. Latinos are nowhere near as loyal to the Democratic Party as Black people are, because they don't have something like that. You know, and with Black people, by the way, eventually, like as time goes on,
it's going to be over for the Dems.
You got to come up with something new. You got to give people stuff for them to maintain their loyalty. But Latinos don't have that kind of loyalty, which is why, even though Latinos vote Democrat, majority of Latinos vote Democrat, it's not as widespread in that it's like Latinos in New York vote Democrats a way higher margin. But Latinos in Florida and Latinos in Texas, you know, it's not just the Cuba thing. Latinos in Texas, which are mostly Mexican-American, they don't vote Democrat as high in as big a margins as they do in New York.
I.e., when you surround Latinx people with white people, we know what's going to happen.
Well, not just that, but it's more that just the Republican Party is dominant there. The Democratic Party is weak. The Democratic Party does nothing. So, like, people just kind of vote for, you know, the party that's dominant party, because the other party's not giving them anything.
And the crucial flaw to this whole demographics or destiny thing is the idea of the staticness of whiteness. Whiteness isn't static. I keep telling y'all this over and over and over and over again. There's nothing more fluid than whiteness. This shit is always changing, always adjusting, always evolving. Like, you know, and again, I'll never stop giving Nando credit for bringing this up to me, New York Times had another piece about the Rio Grande Valley Republicans, about these women who are running for office, who are no longer Democrat, who are Mexican-American, et cetera, et cetera. And the lady who's running for office, her name is, Peña Garza, Miss Peña Garza. She said she was called a coconut growing up, brown on the outside, white on the inside, and a self-hating Latino. That hardened her, okay? And then, Nando, we learned that, what does she do? She peddles insurance. She owns a fucking insurance company out there. That's what she does. Petty bourgeoisie. Of course she's fucking Republican. Are you kidding me? Yeah. Are you shitting me? It doesn't matter that Republicans are deporting people in X, Y, and Z. That's not going to happen to her.
Yeah.
She's good. Why the hell would she care about anti-immigration rhetoric when she's good?
Yeah.
And then on the other side, the Democrats offer her nothing but this sort of racial solidarity weirdness that she should feel in league with Puerto Ricans in the Bronx. And it's like, that don't even what make it make sense, Nando.
Yeah. No, it doesn't make sense. And, you know, the Democrats have believed that all they got to do is some sort of superficial appeal to minorities on by, you know, wearing kente cloth and, you know, saying no human being is illegal. While not, if you don't offer people anything concrete, if you don't give them something, if they don't give them a victory, they'll find that rhetoric hollow. And they'll eventually turn against you. You know, you have to start delivering concrete things to people. I mean, I always say this, like, Trump did way better than expected amongst Latinos in Texas. He did way better expected, especially amongst Latinos in the Rio Grande Valley, which is the border, right? Where he built the freaking wall. This sort of symbol of his anti-immigrant rhetoric was the wall that he built in the southern border. And wait a minute, he did better than expected with Latinos there?
Why is that, Nando?
Because it's a freaking jobs program. It's federal money pouring into this region. You know, like it's money, it's billions of dollars to build this stupid fucking wall, but it's money coming into the region. And it's money giving jobs. Yes. It's, you know,
Did people think that there would be Mexicans who wouldn't try to work on the wall?
Of course. Like, or Border Patrol?
Who would turn down relatively great wages, a pension, benefits, job security, dignified work, because they're Mexican? Yeah. Are you offering me rhetoric? They're offering me tangible things.
Yeah.
And I'm supposed to go with rhetoric out of some idea about my own Mexican identity that I'm supposed to allow the Democratic fucking party to define for me? The Democratic Party gets to define some Mexican border patrollers' Mexican identity? Because what? Like, you can't tell me I'm not a good enough Mexican because I took a job on the border patrol? Motherfucker, yeah. Rent dude.
Yeah.
Who are you? How dare you? And I actually have to be Mexican every day. So shut the hell up. It's, yeah. You know, it's hollow, it's stupid, it's clearly not working.
Yeah.
It's clearly not working. It is so obviously not working for the Dems, and the numbers are bearing it out. And, you know, they're interviewing these people, and, you know, you can't forget, people gotta realize something too, that me as a Black person, I want to say, like, I like became conscious of like how pervasive the shit is and easy to sell it is. Like, it's not hard to turn people anti-Black in America specifically. Like, mm-hmm. It's really not that hard. And I just remember one day looking up and a friend of mine was dating an Indian person. You know, their parents were immigrants of India. The person he was dating was obviously first gen Indian American, whatever. He was like, yo, man, mind you, this is like a fancy ass Negro. You know what I'm saying? College educated, all kinds of MBs and all of that type of shit. And he's like, yo, you know, the family was like, yeah, I don't know at first. I was like, why? He said, because I'm Black. And then when I looked up and I was like, yo, wait a minute. Indians don't fuck with us. Asians don't fuck with us. Clearly white people. large group of Latinx, it's like, it's not hard to turn people against Black people. And like that messaging is still pretty effective. That messaging of, I may be Mexican American, but I'm not Black, it still has its seductions. It's not a different message that was sold to the poor whites of the Deep South. It's the same thing. It's still pretty effective. And, you know, later on in that story, about the women in the Rio Grande who are Republican or whatever, this lady was like, you know, I moved here, Bracero. My parents moved here for Bracero, work in the fields, yada, 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 this and that. And, you know, a lot of them were Democrat, blah, blah, blah. But he's like, she was like, yo, the Democrats are pitching what they're dishing out is free everything and devaluing the value of hard work. We know what that is. We don't have to. That's not even dog whistle. That's a whistle whistle. You know what I'm saying? Like, we know what that rhetoric is, and that rhetoric is effective still. So you have to understand that even within, because again, and I don't exempt myself from this. And I've said this on the show before. My family's West Indian. You know how much anti-Black American rhetoric I've heard come out of their mouths? They're Black. So, again, when you're not offering people an alternative to this sort of racial superiority, yada, 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 you know, feed into their own sort of mythos of how great they are individually. Like, if you're not offering something to take them out of that, i.e. from material gains, you're going to be dead in the water. Like, on Twitch yesterday, I gave the example of Diego Luna, the Mexican actor.
Yeah.
Narcos, great actor. He's one of my faves. Loved him. You telling me that guy's not white? He's Mexican. He's Mexican as they come. He's a fucking white boy.
Yeah.
He's a white boy. So stop with this shit. This whole, you know, cultural and racial solidarity is just going to be it. Because race is the most important thing that God has ever created. As if when somebody gets evicted or they become homeless or they become addicted to drugs, that experience happens differently to them because of their race. It's just the dumbest thing in the world, dude. Or conversely, the opposite, when somebody is able to rent a dope new apartment, you know, finally finance a whip or do whatever, as if that experience is different for somebody because they are white or they are Black. It's just stupid. The things that actually matter out here, you know, somebody owning their first home, et cetera, don't happen to people differently based on their race. And that's what everybody wants. So why are we not trying to give it to them? It's just, it's the stupidest thing in the world, bro.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I doubt anyone will actually learn, actually in the Democratic Party will learn the lesson, you know, at least not anytime soon.
Well, it feels like Biden is trying to learn it. You know, he's
trying Biden, you know, Biden obviously like doesn't think too much, but he has, he has certain decent political instincts, especially like, I mean, he's like the least woke guy in the world, right? I mean, he like I always remember when someone asked him, like a right winger kind of ambushed him and asked him how many genders there are. And he just like had no idea how to respond. And he goes, at least three, you know, so he. Yeah, it is.
That's a great answer.
But he's not wrong. But he doesn't like do the kind of he doesn't do the Hillary Clinton thing of like the hot sauce in my purse,
the hot sauce, you know, in my purse thing. Yeah.
You know, the intersectionality bullshit or anything like that. Like he kind of just appeals to, he's like, no, this is right. We got to do this. You know, like we should do this. We got to help people. I don't know. Like he has like kind of an old school political touch that I think serves him pretty well in the public's eye. But yeah, I mean, I don't think the people who like actually run a lot of these political campaigns will learn the lesson.
Lucy Nicotine is a company founded by Caltech scientists and former smokers looking for a better and cleaner nicotine alternative. Finally, tobacco alternatives that don't suck. Researched and developed for 3 years to be made for people, not patients, Lucy has created a nicotine gum with 4 milligrams of nicotine that comes in 3 flavors, wintergreen, cinnamon, and pomegranate. Lucy also has a lozenge with 4 milligrams of nicotine in cherry ice flavor. Each and every flavor actually tastes great, and it's convenient and discreet. Products can be enjoyed anywhere, on flights, at work, on the go, even at the gym. People, it's 2021. Get rid of your cigarettes, unplug your vape, throw out your dip, and get some Lucy nicotine gum or lozenges. This is the real deal. A subscription to Lucy comes directly to your door each month. It's so simple, and you don't have to leave your house because Lucy has delivery down. Right now, bomb listeners. That's right. This podcast that you're listening to, Black Opinions Matter. You guys all go to lucy.co and use promo code BOM to get 20% off all products on your first order, including gum or lozenges. That's Lucy, L-U-C-Y, .co and use promo code BOM at checkout. Also, I have to give this disclaimer. Warning, this product contains nicotine derived from tobacco. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. Lucy.co, and be sure to use that promo code BOM.
All right, so we move on to more depressing news in Colombia, where riots, protests, whatever you want to call it, the people have hit the streets because they're sick and tired of how they're being treated by the elites. Mm-hmm. They tried to pass a tax reform to address fiscal issues. Yeah. You know, and it's always austerity for the poor, tax cuts for the rich. Like, I don't want to, like, it doesn't, it, yeah. Like, it just, like,
they're taxing basic goods like milk and eggs.
Yeah. And the wealth of the wealthiest Colombians, 100 millionaires. Nah, yeah. You're good. Yeah.
Colombia is an interesting place. Colombia is a place I know well. I've been there a bunch of times. I did a music video there once. I put on a concert there once.
Wow.
I worked there. Yeah.
I never knew that.
I put on a Mark Anthony concert in Colombia.
Wow.
Once. Yeah.
Wow. I bet that was amazing.
Yeah. When we're off the air, when we're drunk one day, I'll tell you a story about J-Lo from that experience. But
Nice.
I can't.
No. We don't want to. We got to keep that behind closed doors.
Yeah. Colombia is an interesting place. Colombia is the second most unequal country in Latin America, which, you know, is saying a lot because Latin American countries are incredibly unequal. And Colombia also has been in a sort of armed struggle for several decades.
It's been like 30 years.
30 years, yeah. So between a left-wing guerrilla group called the FARC and the government, but then the government at one point decided we're going to create these paramilitary groups, which are kind of like outside of the, you know, the government. It's not fair to say the government created the paramilitary groups, although there are rumors and stuff. Like, the paramilitary groups emerged in rural areas, especially where big landowners wanted protection from the FARC and all that stuff. The paramilitary groups then themselves became kind of like these kind of unaccountable side roving kind of death squads, essentially.
Speaking of the CIA.
Yeah, speaking of the CIA, again, a lot of rumors there, you know. As such, Colombia, which was the sort of epicenter of the drug war, the OG drug war, mm-hmm. right? Pablo Escobar, you've all seen Narcos, right? The mm-hmm. DEA was in there, the CIA was in there, the American state. Colombia received more aid than more American aid. Mostly military aid and arms sales than the rest of Latin America combined. So Colombia is a very, very strange place, very, very dominated by this kind of what we would call here like the national security establishment, like these kind of military, it's like a very militarized kind of society in certain ways. Hugely, very, very close ally to the United States and very right wing, like in his politics, incredibly right wing for the most part. As such, they've implemented all kinds of right wing economic reforms. There's all this inequality, you know, and starting in the last, in you know, there's been a kind of social crisis unfolding, but obviously very acutely hit by the pandemic. And there's been these massive protests against this tax, which the government tried to pass. The right-wing government, a guy named Iván Duque, is the president. And he is the kind of political heir to a guy named Álvaro Uribe, who's like this incredibly looming force in Colombian politics. He was the president that kind of most aggressively persecuted the war. And this guy, Iván Duque, tried to put a tax to deal with like the COVID economic crisis, basically on the backs of the poor, through this something called the value added tax, which is basically a sales tax. The people rose up and they've been hitting the streets. The epicenter was in Cali, which is in the south part of the country. You know, you've heard of the Cali cartel.
Speaking of Pablo.
Although he was the Medellin cartel.
He was Medellin. Cali
is his rivals.
Yes.
So they've been rising up and the police and the government have cracked down hard. At least 20 people have been killed. I mean, some of the videos are crazy.
Fucked, man.
I mean, you're seeing like execution style, like killings on the street, you know, it's popping up on social media. It's fucking crazy. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. I mean, it's ongoing. It's unclear whether, like, how, you know, at this point, the government has kind of repealed its attempts to pass this tax. Although, and they said they're going to try again with like a new version or something. But, you know, it's unclear whether that's going to be enough for the protesters and whether they can actually institute a big political change in Colombia. I saw a poll that showed that the sort of left-wing party, what we would call here like a democratic socialist party, was actually surging in the polls as a result of all this. But it's unclear whether that's going to actually happen. Like I said, like the military establishment in Colombia.
How can a left-wing political party even ascend when the military is so dominant? Couldn't they just kill them theoretically?
And that kind of stuff happens a lot in Colombia. Like if you look at the murders of trade unionists around the world, I mean, I remember like back in the day when I was like reading a lot of Chomsky in high school, he wrote a book called Understanding Power. And he talked about how of all the trade unionists killed in the world, this was like back in 2004, of all the unionists, like labor union leaders and stuff killed around the world, like every year they would publish some list, something like 3/4 of them were killed in Colombia.
That's crazy.
You know, like it is incredibly violent place and you know, we think of it in the United States as like violent because of like other reasons, but really it's like the state itself is like very, very violent in Colombia. So yeah, it's been a crazy situation. We've had some people on Twitter hitting us up to talk about it.
As you know, as much as it is relevant to what's going on here domestically, it's, you know, it's neoliberalism run amok, right? Yeah. It's this idea that the markets and capital are always doing the right thing at every turn. They're right. They can never be wrong. At every turn, and even in the midst of a global pandemic, even in the midst of needing, you need more social programs, not less. They can't even find it in their hearts to be like, yo, elite guys, it's beginning to become untenable out there. And it's the shit that I say all the time that sometimes I feel like the short-sightedness of a certain type of elite. I think if all the elites were as forward-thinking as Andrew Yang, who's like, no, I still want to be elite, but like at a certain point, these people are going to come kill us like the French Revolution, bro. Like at a certain point, we should be trying to stop that off at the head by making ourselves look like beautiful, nice benefactors. Like, yes, let's pay for universal monthly income. in the long run, it's going to help us. It's going to maintain established order, keep them at least decently happy, and we get to still run everything. Yeah. But a lot of them are so freaking greedy, bro. And just this idea that, no, we'll just crush them at every turn. It's like, bruh, that shit can only work for so long until they burn down your whole city. And then what's the point of being elite anymore?
Yeah.
You know, and it feels like in Colombia, they're not heeding the Andrew Yang lesson.
There's a famous book called The Leopard that was turned into a movie with Burt Lancaster and Alain Delon and Claudia Cardinale back in the day, written by a guy named the Count of Lampedusa. He was an Italian noble. And he wrote one book, and it was this book. And it tells a story of basically a people's uprising against a small, it was during the unification of Italy, which was saw a lot of uprisings against the landed aristocracy. And he was trying to make the point, the leopard, who was the noble, the leader of the hero of the book, was trying to make the point to everyone around him. He's like, guys, we got to change everything so that everything can stay the same. That's his famous line. You know, he's like, unless we change everything, nothing won't stay the same. You know, that's the point that you're just trying to make. It's like, we got to change everything so that we can maintain our shit. You know?
Yes. Because at a certain point, people are going to become fed up with this shit. And you know, that's the problem that the elites, they just refuse to believe that they could ever lose anything. Yeah. And I think they're foolhardy to think that. Maybe I'm naive. Maybe I'm just a dumb leftist idiot who believes in the power of the people. Maybe I am, but I don't think so. I think at a certain point, this shit just becomes so untenable. And all of the shit that makes it great to be a billionaire no longer exists.
Yeah.
Because it's been burned to the fucking ground.
Yeah.
By a bunch of people that you tried to starve or beat to death.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's our show for today.
Hey, the Real Madrid Chelsea game starts in 10 minutes, bro. I gotta start doing my stretching. You know,
we'll get to doing that. Beautiful. Yeah. Oh, that's the semifinals.
Semifinal, baby.
Man City is already in the finals. Sorry to my PSG friends. Specifically my man Abbas. He's hurting right now. But shouts to Man City for making it to the finals. Pep's going to finally do it.
We'll see. Unless he comes up against Real Madrid, you know, you never know.
Oh, Lord. Here we go.
We'll have to do a live Twitch viewing of if it's Man City, Real Madrid, we should do a live Twitch viewing.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
So, again, please become a Patreon at patreon.com/countthedings. Every single contribution helps. We really appreciate the support that you guys give to the show. Of course, you guys don't know this, but this is Rob Lopez's last day producing on the show. He has moved on to bigger and better things. I don't think he wants to say what his job is yet. I don't know if he's announced yet, so I'm not going to out him. But he's moved on to bigger and better things. But
yeah, he found a slightly hotter girl than us.
Exactly, than us. But we'll have a new producer next week. The train is going to keep moving. Fernando Vila and Big Waz, we're out of here. Peace.
Later.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours, like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more, made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal, simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal, only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.